It's just too hard to know what to do as a person. There's all this stuff telling you, you know, you should skip this straw. You should do this, you should do that. But does it even matter? All of us, you know, want to know, where should we spend our time and effort that it's really going to matter? And how do we make changes that don't cause us to sacrifice the quality of our life in order to do so? And that's where Joro comes in.
Welcome back to another episode of Who's Saving the Planet? Lex Kefauver here, and I will be your host today. We are going to talk about $13.8 trillion. That is how much consumers spent in just the fourth quarter of 2021. Now imagine if we could use that carrot as an incentive for brands to create better products, for consumers to make more educated choices and work that way all the way back upstream, so that we are creating a system of capitalism that is focused on also not dying here on Earth. And one of the key ways to do that is by informing consumers about their choices and giving them an incentive to really consider what they're spending their money on and how perhaps they could change their consumer habits. And that is the focus of our discussion today with Sanchali, the CEO and founder of Joro, an app which is relatively young but already making huge waves. Joro is an app which allows you, the consumer, to track your spending and then see where your most carbon-intensive purchases comes from. And then they give you the opportunity to offset those carbons by purchasing carbon offsets and carbon avoidances right on their platform. So this is an opportunity for you, the consumer, to really have a look into how your money is affecting our collective future. Okay, this is our conversation with Sanchali, the founder and CEO of Joro.
Welcome back to another episode of Who is Saving the Planet? And today we are joined by the fantastic once resident of Boston, Sanchali. And so we're not going to hold that against you at all. My personal Boston feelings aside, welcome aboard.
Thanks, Lex. I appreciate the generosity.
Well, it's you who's being generous with your time, because you're doing something which is incredibly important. We think a lot about how do everyday people engage in climate change in a way that isn't going to have to force us to sacrifice our convenience, because in order to get the maximum amount of people engaged in this, we need to start with the lowest friction barrier to entry. And that's my lead up. That's my sort of like segue into saying, can you tell us about Joro? What is it that you are doing, and how do you envision engaging with an everyday consumer?
Absolutely. I mean, thank you so much for having me. And I think this question you asked is something a lot of us grapple with. I mean, more than 80% of Americans believe that climate change is real. Over a third of us consider ourselves climate alarmed. Research out of your alma mater, Yale, which tells us that, you know, people are really, really concerned, especially when we see, you know, extreme weather events happening, fires, floods, hurricanes, tornadoes at times when they should not be happening. We understand that these things are happening faster and more than ever. And especially also when people are starting to build families, that's something they're thinking about for their children or for their younger siblings, you know, as they're starting to grow up. And it's just too hard to know what to do as a person. There's all this stuff telling you, you know, you should skip this straw. You should do this. You should do that. But does it even matter? All of us, you know, want to know, where should we spend our time and effort that it's really going to matter? And how do we make changes that don't cause us to sacrifice the quality of our life in order to do so? And that's where Joro comes in. Joro is an app that allows you to connect your credit and debit cards, see the emissions behind everything you buy, and track, reduce, and offset all of the emissions from your life. Just like you can track and manage your finances, Joro helps you track and manage your carbon, so that instead of being in constant debt, you can really think about how to build wealth in the future, carbon wealth. And that happens through not only changing your lifestyle, through discovering new, more sustainable actions and companies, that it can also be better for your life. And also through offsetting, through supporting amazing projects around the world that are actually reducing and removing carbon.
So let's just break that down to its simplest form then. You help me understand my impact in the world through looking at my spending and quantifying that as it pertains to emissions. Is that in its short? So this is one of those ideas that feels so obvious, right? This feels like it could be just a bolt-on to any sort of financial product that we have right now. where were you in the world when you said this needs to exist and it doesn't? And then what was the impetus to go build it?
Well, the first time I thought about this existing was when I was a senior in college and I saw the documentary Food Inc. And I also happened to be the manager in my dining hall. And I thought, this is crazy. Like, we're buying all this stuff. I had no idea about the impact that the way I was consuming had on the planet. And I don't even care about eating the things I was eating that much. So let me see, like, if I cut down my meat consumption, you know, I kind of don't think about it that much. But if I cut down my meat consumption, what kind of impact would that have? So I started tracking my carbon footprint from my diet. And I found that if I went down to a couple meat meals a week, I would have the same carbon impact as taking half a car off the road that year. Mm-hmm. And that was huge for me. I was like, you know, I can still eat meat occasionally. I don't have to go fully vegetarian. My life is still great and I can have this huge impact and I feel better. I'm actually saving money. A lot of these actions do save me money. So I kind of had that realization. And then over the next several years, I got kind of nerdy and I built out a really detailed carbon model of my life in an Excel model.
Everything starts in Excel.
Everything starts in Excel, especially if you're an econ major.
Right.
And then I sort of used that to reduce my carbon emissions by 30% over a few years. And I saved over $2,000 a year by doing that. So that was kind of how I figured it out.
So it's interesting that you put two things together. One is this sense of like personal altruistic validation. You did something that was good and it made you feel good. That's awesome. And the second is a sort of straight up financial calculation. Here's the money that you saved. I wonder how you think about how to get most people, how to get enough people to engage in like a tipping point for this, using the incentive structures that actually motivate people to do things, because it needs to be more than just rationality or altruism or, you know, even an existential fear of the future. Those things are all prevalent and have been for a while. And we're not seeing that have a demonstrable effect on consumer markets. So what do you think is going to unlock that?
I think the most powerful thing that we and, you know, the climate communities really need to tap into is social validation. People want to look good. Even people who care about the planet want to look good. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we've learned from the work that we've done too, is that following friends matters. If someone's following you on the app, you're much more likely to reduce carbon. You reduce carbon by 20% more than if no one was following you on the app. Being able to share your progress with others and say, hey, look at this amazing thing I did. This is part of my identity as a person. I'm a sustainable consumer. This is something I care about. That sort of positive effect, I think, is something that really is powerful and can be tapped into. And there certainly are financial motivators as well. You know, saving money is a huge one. Also giving people benefits if they do better and giving them incentives. Maybe that's a deal off of a sustainable product or service. We don't do this yet, but it's certainly something I could see us getting into as the community grows.
So that's that then, it's not just something that is an isolated sort of, you know, you built your Excel models to track your own spending, but what you're describing there is more of a social network, something that is, you're demonstrating the good works that you do so that you can have that glow reflected back on you from the other community of good doers. That's also part of your platform and your ecosystem?
Certainly. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call it a social network, but it's probably a platform that's going to build all existing.
Well, I guess I think of it like, you know, when you Venmo someone and you can like put in your notes what it is, and like that has this whole cachet now where people can like deconstruct your lifestyle by your Venmo charges. That's like kind of what this feels like, right? Like I can sort of deconstruct who you are. Like personally, I have a company that focuses on fashion and I am the least best dressed person in the world because like I'm willing to buy whatever it is that's best for the planet. But I spent my 20s working in a steakhouse. And so like, I do have an affinity for like a very well cut cut of steak. And so like, there's definitely a trade-off that I'm willing to make, which could be exactly the opposite of one that you are. But by together us working on this and sort of like understanding where those trade-offs are, perhaps then neither one of us need to feel bad about the indulgences that we do take while still getting credit for the ones that we're willing to, or not even willing, eager to give up for our collective well-being.
I mean, it absolutely is about the community because that's what makes this all work. One is that people don't want to feel like they're alone. You know, obviously me taking that half a car off the road only matters if there's thousands of other people doing that as well. And so it makes your actions more valid. And it also is a place where you can seek motivation, encouragement, inspiration. Things are always better when you do them with others, and especially in the context of climate. This isn't an individual problem. It's a collective problem.
Right. Have you noticed a tipping point then from a per user aspect where there's some famous tropes about this, right? Where like when Twitter first started, they realized once you follow 7 people on Twitter, you're more likely to be engaged. Or in Facebook, once you connect with 10 friends, your engagement increases exponentially. Have you noticed something like that with your users, like some sort of action that has a disproportionate reaction in terms of their affinity with and engagement with your product?
There's certainly a few. I think we're still at the phase where we're trying to figure out all these amazing companies, they found that tipping point, and that was really what unlocked huge scale. Yeah. And that's really the point where we're at now, is that we see a few things that people are doing. One is just connecting that card on your first day. 90% of people who connect a card to the app do so on the first day they get into the app. If they don't do it, it's very hard to get them to do it after that. And right. That's something that's a real activation moment. If you get someone to the point where they're like, yeah, I'm going to connect my financial information to this app right away, then that's someone who's going to be engaged over time. And then also, either following a friend or engaging with one of the actions in the app in the first week is also something that we look for. So one of the actions in the app could be reading an article about something, a guide to some sort of climate related thing, or buying an offset, or starting a home energy challenge or something like that. But starting that in the first week, or engaging with your first carbon report within the first week, are all things that really indicate someone's going to be engaged.
How do you guys make money?
Right now, the app is free to use, and it always will be. We want it to be free to track your carbon footprint, kind of like Credit Karma made it always free to see data about yourself. That's mm-hmm. true for Joro too. We make money if you decide to buy offsets. So if you say, hey, this is my carbon footprint, I would like to go carbon neutral, I'm going to buy offsets through Joro, then we take a fee for managing that transaction and for monitoring, evaluating, and curating the set of offsets that you're buying into, because not all offsets are created equal. The truth is.
So glad you brought that up. We're definitely going to go down that rabbit hole.
There's some really shitty offsets. Again, as a consumer, I experienced this. I started doing research. How do I buy offsets? Took me a month, took me 2 months, took me 6 months, took me a year. Finally, I found a project that I felt relatively confident in. And then we don't want consumers to have to do that work. So we're doing that for you. We're vetting and evaluating projects on a rolling basis. We're talking with some of the best and most sophisticated buyers of carbon offsets, like Stripe, Shopify, Microsoft. We're talking to the carbon plans, the EDFs, the folks who are plugged into what's going on the verification side. And we're rigorously evaluating every project that comes through. We've done 30 rigorous evaluations of companies that have passed our screening process, and only 6 of them have made it into the portfolio so far. And so we're doing that on behalf of our customers.
That's funny. That 30 and 6 metric is almost identical to what Microsoft's metric was when they were looking at their carbon offsets, or at least I only think 6 of them made it in, but they had more than that, 50 or 60 projects that they were looking at. We're seeing a proliferation of offset markets. So everyone wants to get into the middleman game. And the actual projects of creating offsets is totally lagging behind that, which could be good, right? Perhaps that means there's outsized demand for this, and we just need to create more opportunities to fulfill that demand. But what's filling the void is, as you said, so many dubious. One example that was told to me was a hydroelectric dam was built in China in 2007. And they're still trading offsets on that today, as though, even though it is built, even though it is running, even though it has no more financial need to generate carbon offsets, you're still thinking that you're offsetting your cross-continental flight by giving money to this hydroelectric dam, which is already running. And there's a middleman there making, an arbitrage fee for your opportunity to do that. So what's your process? How do you untangle that? Because that in and of itself is a massive undertaking before you're even talking about customer acquisition or building a good product.
We didn't set out to do the carbon evaluation ourselves. We talked to a lot of verifiers and evaluators to try to partner with them. But the truth is, there's no single common standard yet. And it's really challenging, especially when you want to buy offset projects across different mechanisms like forestry or agriculture or direct air capture. There's no single unified body that is evaluating rigorously across all of those different types. And so we found we had to do a lot of the work ourselves. But the process we take is, first we have a screening. So projects don't even make it into those 30 that get evaluated. We need to make sure that they're not just avoidance credits, they're actually reduction and removal credits that are actually more additional in their ability to draw carbon down. So we don't look at projects like renewable energy projects or cook stoves or things like that. When we do look at a project, we also look at recent vintages. We look at plus or minus 5 years only. And that means we are buying some forward contracts for the types of projects that are really long duration carbon removals. And then we have a really rigorous process that has two steps. The first is looking at carbon integrity. Does this project really reduce or remove the carbon it says it is? And there we go deep into the documentation on the project. We talk to the project owners, we talk to the CEOs of the companies, and we look at, is this permanent, additional, verifiable, enforceable, and are they transparent with their data? And then we also look at, for our customers, is this creating the kind of world that I as a person want to live in? Does it have that transformative potential to create a just and sustainable world? And that includes things like biodiversity protection, community involvement, and innovation. And we sort of prioritize projects based on those criteria.
So that's interesting, because these sound like almost two separate business functions that do have a tangential intersection. You know, like the Venn diagram here of these two business operations is important, but it feels like kind of small, right? On one hand, you have a consumer-facing business that's focused on consumer behaviors and personal choice and validation through a social currency. And on the other hand, a strict B2B business where you're working with these businesses to do a evaluation of something that is highly technical. And in the middle, there is this point, right? There is this, that's Simon, that's my dog. He wants to say hi to. In the middle, there is this point, right? This nexus where like you live, where you can say, I can connect one to the other, but they both seem like a ton of work. So how are you gaining efficiencies by both of these? Or how do you see this building into a competitive advantage or something that like validates running these two parallel operations simultaneously?
Well, I think the intersection is exactly the value that people need, that is so difficult for the average consumer, is how do I translate the emissions from my life into something I can do about it? Both of those things are hard. And so what we started, the first product we launched was literally just the emissions from my life. How do I see the emissions from my life? Basically just the Credit Karma see your credit score type of product. But we learned very quickly that that's very disheartening for a customer. It's like if all of a sudden, like, you know, you didn't know how much debt you were accumulating in your life, and all of a sudden we made a product that showed you all your debt. It just feels bad. Instead, we need an opportunity to like, how do we make that better? How do we build some sort of wealth or positive side of this carbon equation? And that's where offsets can be the sort of fastest, easiest path before you change anything about your life. And we found that people did want something that was that easy button that gave them that validation. I can do this. I can get to net zero today. Within 2 minutes, I can be a net zero person. Then it's all up from there. It's all improvements from there. And so that was really the impetus behind offering the offset product and realizing that what's hard for the consumer is not only knowing what their emissions are, but also prioritizing where they should put their money or their time in order to change it.
So this is like a freemium model where you are aware of your impact. You feel good about doing something different by voluntary choice. And then you say, you know what? I want to go the step further and I want to engage with this net zero lifestyle, and I'd be willing to pay a subscription or something like that to help fund access to verified offsets that I believe in and I can trust. Is that about right?
Yeah.
So, okay, I want to take this idea and expand it into the ridiculous world in which we live in. Adam Neumann has just launched a carbon coin called Flow Carbon. Adam Neumann, of fame for being one of the most singular destructors of fake or paper wealth with the taking WeWork from a $64 billion valuation down to four. And he's come out with this product that says, hey, this is a coin that we're going to essentially track and monetize the price of carbon and then offer that as a currency. Now, the reason why I bring that up is because there seems to be some kind of parallel here with the amount of inventiveness that's going on in terms of taking this idea that carbon should be worth something and then creating a vehicle for people to engage with that worth. And you were talking about that too, with the way that you say, like, I want to have an emotional value with it. I want that currency to be expressed with by community and also to be incentivized by it. How do you see these other constructions that are happening in the Web3 cryptocurrency world that are related to this idea of quantifying carbon apply to what your actual customer base is, which is everyday people who are making choices about what they buy?
I think that at the core of a lot of these new plays is the sort of same desire to quantify and value carbon at the individual level. I mean, when I first started thinking about this idea, I started realizing that I was an actor in a carbon credit market that was invisible to me. And I wanted to make it visible and I wanted to be an intentional participant in that market. And so I think there's a lot of, in theory, there's a lot of value to what Web3 could bring to be able to incentivize people to participate in carbon markets. Mm-hmm. Specifically, carbon is an invisible thing we cannot see. It is very difficult to understand and it is very difficult to value because the value of carbon is in the external sort of consequences of our economy that we don't really quantify right now.
But isn't that like the tremendous irony? The value of it is almost as pure and it's almost as purely equated to the value of the future as anything else ever has been, right? Money is like a construct.
Right. But it is the opposite of a discount rate.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so like, if you were to say here, we can put a value on future generations of humanity, pricing carbon is as close to that as we have come with any of the other financial instruments that are out
there. Exactly. So there's no doubt that putting a price on carbon and setting that price appropriately to represent the value to future generations is critical to being able to address the climate crisis. However, I don't think that most of the plays that we've seen so far in Web3 have figured out the incentives that really will drive carbon reduction and removal rapidly in the next 10 years. Because there is a disincentive sort of built in, is like, if you do nothing about the climate crisis, the price of carbon will go up. And so that is something that's very tricky, I think, to solve. We also, with these types of plays, cannot solve the fact that the quality on the supply side is not there yet. And the quantity on the supply side is not there yet. And so we're playing this kind of tricky game where we need to drive up demand in order to create more investments in supply. But the demand plays are actually not really incentivizing us to retire the supply. They're incentivizing us to bet that more supply will come on board, but not actually to buy them right away. They're incentivized to wait.
So how do we, there's a sleeping giant in the room, which is the $64 trillion of consumer spend that is being not utilized in the majority of this market, right? There's the global GDP that right now is sitting on the sidelines for the most part, and the carbon markets are a tiny, tiny part of this whole thing. And in theory, like, what Joro could do is activate that in a passive way and giving people an avenue to become an active participant in it, as you are literally the poster child for that. How do you see that playing out over the next 5-10 years?
It's hard to say, but I do think that where the value of Joro is we can connect your everyday actions you're already doing, your financial behavior that you're already engaging with carbon markets. We mm-hmm. translate your current financial behavior in terms of your spending into carbon. And that can become a basis to partner with many other protocols. So if you can, all of a sudden you can quantify your carbon, you can translate that. If there are reliable protocols, I think, especially ones that are valuing carbon appropriately and looking for high quality carbon credits, then there's a lot of potential to use Turo as a way to connect to other vehicles to be able to then monetize and even use the value of the carbon that you've created in the product.
Is there a way to directly incentivize consumers? So like literally say, we're going to put money back into your pocket from making better choices.
As long as there's a buyer for that, you know, I mean,
if like, we think about like the Web3, you know, some of these ideas around how do we, the decentralized autonomous network, right? Every tweet can be worth something to the person that tweets it idea. And it's simply saying that we are all creators in this global creator economy. Take that down to its true like unitary measure, you as a person. If you're saying like, here's a baseline of what an average person spends in terms of their carbon, you go below that, you make money. You go above that, you spend money. And it's basically like a cap and trade for individual choice.
I mean, to be honest, that's kind of what it is now, is that you spend less, you pay less. You know, if you expend less carbon, your carbon offset subscription is less with Turo. We have people who spend as little as $10 a month on their carbon offset subscription. If you have a higher carbon lifestyle, you spend more. So some people pay over $1,000 a month for their carbon offsets. And that's proportional to your actual emissions, which has to do with how much you're spending. So I do think that's part of the value of this product, is that it is personalized. Mm-hmm. And it would be, I think it's definitely possible that in the next few years, we could have some sort of trading system that allows people who are emitting less to actually earn money on that.
If anything, it's sort of like a graduated tax, right? The people that are expending the most carbon are generally the ones that lead the lifestyles that open themselves up to things like traveling on planes quite a lot. That's one of the most carbon intensive things you can do. And that's not available to a lot of people that are in a more socioeconomically challenged position. And so if we can sort of like take some of that money and then give it back to the people that need it more, perhaps there's a good thing in there without straying too far away from capitalism.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it plays on the built-in incentive of, you know, emit more, pay more, emit less, pay less.
I also love the idea that like, if you have more wealth, the incremental value of social validation is so much more as opposed to like the dollar amounts. And if you have much less wealth, the dollar amounts are probably going to impact your lifestyle a lot more. And so everyone's kind of getting what they need out of that. We're clearly now we're like extrapolating on like how to solve the climate crisis writ large. But I think that's what our job is here at Who's Saving the Planet.
I think so. And also, I mean, there's been some incredible research in the last few months, especially coming out of Oxfam on carbon inequality, which directly maps to income inequality. And it all comes back to the fact that, like, you know, money maps to carbon. And, you know, it showed that the top 10% of wealthiest people around the world have contributed over 50% of global emissions over the last 15 years. Also, the last IPCC report that came out just a month or so ago specifically called out high-income folks as the most capable of having meaningful impact while also maintaining high standards of living. And so I think there's just, you know, if you make over $60,000 a year in the US, you're in the top 10% wealthiest of the world. And those are the people who really are going to be thinking about their carbon emissions. If you're below that, you have a lot of other things to worry about. Right. They're going to be way more important. Yeah.
And if Maslow's hierarchy is sitting on top of you, you don't necessarily have that luxury.
If you start to have disposable income and you're starting to spend more than you need, that's when paying attention to the carbon of your lifestyle can be really valuable.
Mm-hmm. All right. So there's one other aspect to this whole thing. I think like this is half of the huge question, which is the top-down approach, the carbon market approach, these flows of money in a very sort of big way. The other end is the bottom-up approach, which is to say, how do we actually know how much carbon goes into stuff? And I think a lot about this, like in general, because a lot of the ways that we are measuring carbon are heuristics that are built on assumptions, because it's just so hard. Like a life cycle analysis is sort of considered the gold standard for understanding the greenhouse gas emissions, water footprint, carbon intensity of a thing. And it's incredibly expensive and non-scalable. Mm-hmm. So how do you think about the thing that you are measuring, right? How much carbon goes into it? If I go buy a pair of shoes, not all shoes are created equal. How do you granularize that to the degree that you can understand whether I'm buying a pair of shoes made of soybeans from On Running versus a pair of Air Jordans.
Yeah. So the way I think about this is the goal of knowing your carbon emissions is being able to make better decisions. So it only matters, accuracy only matters in that it's actionable. What we want to be able to do with Joro is help people see the relative impact of the choices they're making. Where are my biggest levers for impact? Which are the choices that matter most? For instance, it's really interesting to know that my commute to work is about the same carbon footprint as what I eat for lunch. So those are kind of trade-offs that are equivalent that I should be thinking about as equally important. When it comes to carbon footprinting, that implies that there's like also sort of a sweet spot of how accurate we should be without requiring too much manual input from the user, getting too detailed into the granularity of someone's choices. There's two approaches to carbon footprinting. The one you described, an LCA analysis or life cycle assessment, is from the bottom up. It says like, what are all the things that went into this specific shoe? Mm-hmm. And what was the supply chain for this specific shoe? And that might be radically different than another shoe. It might be radically different than another study on the same shoe, because it's going from the bottom up, and different people might approach that in different ways, but it's very specific and very expensive. Then there's top-down analysis, which is economic level analysis, which is how we estimate the carbon emissions of our country. We look at the GDP flows across industries, and we quantify the carbon for all of the different flows, like steel manufacturing, wood and furniture. Each of those products has a carbon intensity per dollar that's used at the national level for national averages.
Right.
What we do at Joro is we start with a top-down approach, and we supplement it with a bottom-up, where there's data. And so we say, like, okay, in general, groceries in the United States have a carbon footprint of about this much per dollar. But then you as a person live in this place, and you as a person have this dietary preference. So your carbon footprint is going to be different from someone else's. And so for every sort of type of purchase, we're constructing analyses from top down and bottom up using national, local, user, and transaction level data sets.
So I think this is where that's great, first of all. And I appreciate you breaking that down in a way that is so digestible. Pun not intended, because you were just talking about groceries. But I think this is where sort of like the other part of what blockchain or Web3, if one part of it is this idea of cryptocurrencies being able to commoditize a carbon expenditure and using that in terms of the global flow of money and how it incentivizes things to do that. The other part is, how do we then create a scalable, democratized, and cheap LCA analysis such that we can actually differentiate the different carbon intensities of all of these things that we're talking about without having to blow up the price point? Because from a consumer perspective, like, I'm going to buy shoes, someone needs to tell me which shoes to buy. And if that question can be answered, it's also useful in incentivizing the companies to make the least carbon intensive shoes so that the customers that are looking for that will come to them as a competitive advantage.
I mean, I think that's the most important point there is, where do I buy my shoes from? That's the most important question. Not necessarily which model of shoe should I buy, but where should I buy it from? Because I think that's where the real incentivization happens, is if I know that Nike is better than Adidas, then Adidas is going to start paying attention to the carbon efficiency of its supply chains overall. And that's where we're focusing right now, is actually getting to vendor level estimates. Mm-hmm. So we can say, you know, you spent $100 on PG&E. Did you know that Arcadia might be a great solution for you?
Right.
Or you spent $100 at Adidas. Did you know Allbirds could be a great alternative for you? So that's where we're focusing our efforts. And I think is really going to be powerful going forward, is really at the company level and incentivizing companies to make those hard choices about reducing the emissions in their supply chains.
100%. And once we can galvanize consumers to be champions for sustainability with their wallet, in addition to their, to how they answer surveys, perhaps then we can really start moving the needle here. Okay. You've been so generous with your time. And I want to ask one final question, as I do of most all of our guests. You are now three, four years into Joro. How long has it been?
3 years.
So relatively new to this, but I'm sure those 3 years have been a hard fought battle at every turn. Is there any advice that you would give the Sanchali that was just starting off this journey, or other people who are thinking about engaging with climate in a way that is also reflective of their career, of their life, and not just sort of like, you know, their personal choices, but really aligning those two things. So what advice would you give the younger you? And then what advice would you give anyone who's saying, I really want this to be a bigger part of my life?
I think when I first started on this journey, I felt very intimidated by climate. I felt like I didn't know anything about it. You know, I was an econ major. I worked in consulting. I was curious about climate. And I was really, I'd always been interested and passionate about sustainability, but I didn't necessarily feel like I didn't have a PhD in, you know, energy systems or anything. The truth is, if you spend money, you're making climate choices every day. We're all using energy and resources. It's not rocket science. It's part of when you fill gas at the tank, when you flip your lights on, when you eat, when you buy clothes, when you get on a plane. Those are all choices we all make, we all understand. And it just takes energy to power them. And a lot of our energy comes from fossil fuels. Therefore, you're participating. You know what it takes to address the climate crisis. You see it in your daily life. I think that's the biggest advice I would give a younger me. I wasn't confident in my ability to start this company by myself. I'd never worked in tech before. I had never worked in climate, really. I worked at Tesla briefly for an internship. But I felt like I needed a technical co-founder. And to be honest, a lot of investors told me that I needed a technical co-founder. But a few investors told me that I could do it. And they were like, you know, who understands this problem better than you? You've been living and breathing this user problem for 6 years as you've been building your own Excel model and trying to understand the carbon emissions of your life and going through that user journey every day. If you understand the user and the user problem and you're deeply passionate about it, you can do it. You know, you can do it on your own. I wish I had realized that earlier. I think it took me a while to build the confidence in myself to actually go out and build this company for real and raise money and do it. It took me a year after I had the idea to actually get started and go raise the money and start this company as a solo founder. So that's something I would have told myself. And that's something I want to communicate to anyone who cares about climate is like, the people who are making these decisions at the corporate level, at the government level, they're not smarter than you. You know, they don't have more information about climate change than you do. It's all publicly available. You and me understand we have about 10 years to cut global emissions in half. There's a lot of shit we got to do in that time to make that happen. And something like 40 to 70% of the emissions reductions we need can come from changes on the demand side. And that includes a lot of changes from consumers in our lifestyles. And we're the ones who are on the cutting edge, reimagining what our world is going to look like. And companies and governments aren't going to magically make those choices. They make it because their customers and their citizens demand it. So I think what I would say is we probably have a lot more power than you think, especially when we act together. No matter who you are, no matter where you are, if you spend money, if you have a job, you can take climate action.
Okay. I think there's no better spot to leave it than that. And Shali, thank you so much for coming on board. The product is called the Joro app. Where can people find it?
Find it on the App Store or the Play Store. It's J-O-R-O, Joro, means protector of the earth. And you can find it in the US and Canada.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming on board and keep us updated. We'd love to hear how these stories play out over the next couple of years.
Thank you so much.